Four Perfect Pebbles, Chapter 7, Freedom and Sorrow. The liberation of the death train prisoners had taken place about a mile and a quarter from the small village of Trobisz in eastern Germany. At first, many of the passengers hesitated to leave the train. They were too ill, too weak, or too timid to venture onto German soil on their own. But the Russian soldiers soon made it clear that they had no supplies to share with the former prisoners and were, in fact, assigned to move on north toward Berlin. They also assured the refugees that most of the German population of Trobisz had fled and that most of the abandoned farmhouses contained food, clothing, and bedding that were theirs for the taking. "So before that day was out," Ruth said, "we left the train and headed for the village. Just as the Russians had said, many farmhouses were empty. In the first one I entered, I sniffed a faint but delicious smell of smoked meat. Following the scent, I climbed up to the second floor and found an attic with cured hams and sausages hanging from the rafters. At once, I cut down a ham and brought it with me to the lower floor. Although we had not been deeply observant Jews when we lived in Germany, we had never eaten pork. But even Jewish law recognizes that there may be a time of great need. For us, this was the first plentiful protein we had had in years, and our bodies craved this nourishment. Marion was at this time 10 and a half years old and weighed only 35 pounds. I myself weighed 75 pounds. The Trobisz farmhouses were well stocked, too, with milk, butter, cheese, and eggs. Pigs, cows, and even chickens had been left behind, as well as heavy jugs of preserved fruits and vegetables. Marion delighted in the sweet jams and preserves on the farmhouse shelves, but she soon learned that a shrunken stomach and a starved body must be fed very slowly and gradually. Many of the former prisoners fell too greedily on the rich and abundant food. Some actually died of the sudden overeating. The farmhouse that the Blumenthals had entered became their new living quarters. It was a small house, Marion remembered, and we had it mostly to ourselves. Even though we could have spread out a little, we all slept in one room. Papa was in very poor health by this time, and my leg was still a raw and open wound. After huddling together on the train for 2 weeks, we feared the slightest separation. We wanted to stay as close to each other as my four perfect pebbles, the little stones that I could hold in the palm of my hand. After the Russian liberators of the death train move on, other Russian units arrived in Trobisz to secure the conquered region for the formal occupation forces that were to follow. The military, too, foraged in the village and the surrounding countryside for food and other supplies, for they were often poorly equipped. "In their crude way, though," Marion said, "the Russians tried to help us as best they could. They were extremely good to me, for each day they transported me to a nearby Russian army field hospital where they treated my leg. First they would clean the wound, and then they would sprinkle it with a greenish-yellow powder. Mama and I believed that this powder was a form of penicillin, a miracle drug for infections that had been discovered before the war. As the first weeks in Trobisz went by, we noticed that new skin was beginning to form around the large, burned area of the wound. Mama and I were sure that the nourishing diet, including milk, eggs, and meat, that I was now eating was also helping my body to renew itself. But there was little that could be done to help my nightmares go away. Every day at the hospital, I heard the cries of pain of both soldiers and civilians who had been maimed in the war. Worst of all, I saw the ugly stumps of the amputees. It was only then that I allowed myself to realize how close I had come to having my own leg amputated. These terrors haunted my nights in the farmhouse. I'm sure that was one reason why we all remained sleeping in the one room." Despite their newfound freedom, the Trobisz refugees continued to suffer a serious threat to their lives. Of the 2,500 prisoners who had boarded the death train at Bergen-Belsen, several hundred had died of typhus before reaching Trobisz. Some, delirious with fever, unaware of their surroundings, had been carried from the train to the village in hand carts. In the first weeks at Trobitz, new cases began to break out, and the refugees realized that the germ-bearing lice were still with them. Many who had not already shaved their heads did so in order to deprive the lice of a place to hide and breed, and Marianne at last allowed Mama to shave hers. The dead were now being buried in common graves known as telescope graves on the outskirts of the village. These burial pits were so named because they could be expanded according to need. Each time a body was added, the soil to cover it was dug from the ground directly beside it, creating a new hollow for the next body. On May 7, 1945, the villagers learned from the radio of Germany's surrender. The war in Europe was at an end. Rejoicing with mixed concern, however, for the Russian occupation forces now informed the refugees that they would have to remain in Trobitz until the typhus epidemic had abated. A quarantine period of roughly 2 months was imposed. During that time, none of the former prisoners would be allowed to leave Germany. "We tried to settle down to some kind of life in that place," Marianne said. As the food that had remained in the farmhouses was consumed, people began to go on foot or by bicycle to quite distant farms and villages to beg, borrow, or trade in order to keep their families nourished. My brother, Albert, was an expert at this. He was always off somewhere scrounging for food and other necessities. In many ways, although only 12 and a half years old, he was becoming the provider of our family. For since the journey on the death train, Papa's health had worsened. Before our life in the camps, Papa was a proud and disciplined man, always very exacting and in control of every situation. During Bergen-Belsen, especially, it must have hurt him terribly to watch his family suffer and to be unable to help us. Once he had been a heroic defender of his country and a respected businessman, as well as a loving and caring husband and father. But the Nazi system had broken him down and robbed him of his self-esteem. Yet he continued to have hope, always carrying with him the German-English dictionary from which he studied, for he still planned that one day we would all go to America. As spring came to the Trobitz countryside, freshly grown vegetables began to be available, and the food supply improved. The month of May also saw a decline in the number of typhus deaths. At last, the disease seemed to have run its course, and the refugees began to look forward to returning to their home countries. For the Blumenthals, repatriation would mean a return to Holland. But suddenly, as May warmed into June, the number of typhus cases began to mount again. "And this time," Marianne said, "Papa was one of its victims. Just as the Germans had tried to kill us in their own last moments, so this last gasp of the typhus epidemic would not let Papa go. For days, he lay in the farmhouse bedroom, suffering from the burning fever, the stabbing headaches, and the weird fantasies and semi-consciousness of the disease. And then, one morning, Albert went to his bedside and saw that he was dead. I think we were all numb with the shock of Papa's death. We had come so far through flight, imprisonment, evacuation, the Nazis' final attempt to destroy us, liberation at last, and now this, freedom and sorrow. Mama, too, had been stricken with typhus and was in the early weak stage of recovery. My leg was still in need of treatment, and I could not walk without difficulty. So the task of burying Papa was left to Albert. By this time, the telescope graves had been replaced by single graves dug in a row just outside the wall of the Trobitz village cemetery. There was no possibility of obtaining a coffin for Papa's body. Albert simply wrapped him in the bedsheet on which he'd lain when he died. This became his shroud. Then, with the help of two former prisoners who had been on the train with us, my brother placed Papa's body onto a wheeled cart with two handles in front and two in back. The men helped him to trundle the cart to the cemetery. There, Albert dug a shallow grave, perhaps 4 or 5 feet deep. He placed Papa's body in the earth, covered it, and laid bricks all around it end to end to mark the site. The date of Papa's death was June 7th, 1945. One day after Walter Blumenthal was buried, the Trobitz residents were notified abruptly that their quarantine period had come to an end. They were given 2 hours to gather their belongings and board the column of trucks that awaited them. They were about to begin the first stage of repatriation to their former homelands. Although the Blumenthals were not Dutch citizens, their refugee status would take them back to Holland, the country to which they had fled after leaving Germany. Somehow, Mama and Marion were helped onto the back of one of the open trucks. Albert was to join them, but as usual, he was out somewhere gathering a supply of food for the journey. As the time for the departure came closer, Mama wrung her hands in despair. What if something had now befallen Albert? Where was he? At the very last moment, he came running with his knapsack full, and he clambered aboard. Hands reached out to steady him, but suddenly the truck lurched forward. The jolt loosened Albert's grip on the heavy knapsack, and it flew off his shoulders and bounced onto the road. There it lay, in a receding cloud of dust, as the truck picked up speed. "So," Marion said, "Albert lost his treasured knapsack, which he had had with him since Westerbork. But this was nothing compared to with what we and so many others were leaving behind. There in the Trobitz Cemetery lay well over 100 dead, plus hundreds more in the mass graves on the outskirts of the town and beside the railroad embankment. All told, at least 600 people, one quarter of the 2,500 prisoners who had boarded the death train in Bergen-Belsen, had perished from disease or exhaustion." Chapter 8, Holland Again. "Once more," Ruth said, "we arrived in Holland as refugees, homeless and penniless. The first time had been in January 1939, 2 months after Kristallnacht and Walter's imprisonment in Buchenwald. Now it was the summer of 1945. 6.5 years had passed. We had just barely managed to survive the camps. Walter was dead, and I was a widow at the age of 37. My worry about my two young children was the only thing that gave me the strength to face the future. And yes, there was a new name for us. We were no longer refugees. Now we were displaced persons. To put it more accurately, we were stateless." Marion's memories of the return to Holland were more pleasant than Mama's and more filled with hope. "I remember," she said, "that after we left Trobitz, we stopped in Leipzig, a much larger place, also in eastern Germany. There was an army hospital where my leg, still very painful, was given further treatment. The weather was very hot. I recall sitting on a long wooden table and being served cold beer in large mugs. It was not unusual in Europe to give children and even babies a little beer to drink to nourish their bodies. My body must have craved this nourishment, for the beer tasted delicious. Later in the journey, we stopped at a cloister near Maastricht, the Dutch city that is wedged between Belgium and Germany. I thought it was very exciting to be able to stand with one leg in Holland and one in Belgium, while waving an arm in farewell in the direction of Germany. From there, we went on to Amsterdam. Although the city had suffered much during the war and many of its trees had been cut down for firewood, it seemed a very luxurious place to me. On our arrival, we stayed briefly with Papa's cousins, whom I knew as Tante Gerda and Uncle Ernst. Uncle Ernst de Levy was Jewish, but Tante Gerda, who was not, had managed to conceal his identity from the Nazi during the war. I thought that they and their 17-year-old daughter, Ingrid, were the most handsome people I had ever known. Tante Gerda wore her smooth, dark hair in a French knot, known as a chignon, at the nape of her neck. She understood at once how much I craved small treats of food and clothing. I was still scrawny and underweight, and my hair had not yet grown in. Also, I wore glasses, which I had had to wear from the age of 4 because my eye muscles were not in balance. As a result of this problem, I was slightly cross-eyed. Marion could vividly recall the de Levy's second-floor apartment in a tall, narrow Amsterdam building. Although their home was comfortably furnished, the de Levy's, like other Dutch citizens, still suffered from war shortages. All clothing was rationed, and coupons had to be saved up. But Tante Gerda managed to buy Marion her first piece of new clothing, a flower-patterned summer dress. Another hard-to-obtain item was chewing gum. Marion was intrigued with this unusual confection, and when Uncle Ernst offered her an allowance equivalent to about 10 cents a week, she eagerly saved her coins to buy a single chiclet. "I don't know how many weeks," Marion said, "I kept that one piece of chewing gum. Each day I would chew it, carefully wrap it up, and then chew it again the next day. I also remember how upset I became when I got a stain on the flowered dress that Tante Gerda had bought me. I wore it one day on an outing to an amusement park where I rode the carousel. As the painted horse on which I was seated went up and down, I must have hit my chin. As a result, my tooth bit into my lip, causing some drops of blood to fall on my beautiful new dress. Tante Gerda, though, was not angry. She was comforting and reassuring, all of which made me feel even more unhappy and undeserving." The stay with the DeLevy family could not last, however. Soon, Mama and Marion and Albert were transferred to the former Jewish convalescent home in Amsterdam. The 8-story building had been converted into a temporary shelter for 75 to 100 displaced persons. Although the accommodations were simple, life was no longer filled with fear and uncertainty. Hunger had ceased to be an everyday sensation, and it was possible to bathe, to wear freshly washed clothing, even to brush one's teeth every morning. In October, Albert reached his 13th birthday and became bar mitzvah in a small, quiet ceremony at an Amsterdam synagogue. So that he would have a special gift to mark the occasion, Mama sold Papa's pocket watch and bought Albert a ring. Mama's worries about the family's future were far from over, however. The children needed to be educated, and Ruth herself had no way of providing a livelihood for the three of them. Perhaps, she reasoned, Papa's plan of emigrating to Palestine was the best idea after all. Hundreds of thousands of displaced Jews, broken and impoverished families like the Blumenthals, hoped to be able to make a new start in Palestine. True, the British were still limiting immigration to only about 1,500 a month, and conditions in the desert-like land were harsh and often inhospitable. But there were plans afoot to develop a Jewish state in Palestine, one that would become a permanent home for the Jews. So, soon after Albert's bar mitzvah, Marion said, he and I were sent to a youth aliyah home in the small town of Bussum, about an hour's train ride south of Amsterdam. There we were to be prepared for aliyah, or immigration, to the future Jewish homeland. We would be taught both the Hebrew language and the Orthodox religion. The home was on spacious grounds with a vegetable garden, chickens, and rabbits, and Albert and I had the company of the 20 or so other children, ranging in age from 8 to 18. Some were orphans, while others, like us, had one surviving parent. Mr. and Mrs. Birnbaum, who ran the home and did the teaching, were also survivors of Westerbork and Bergen-Belsen. They had 6 children, 2 of whom were close in age to Albert and me, their daughter, Susie, and their son, Zev. While living and studying at the Youth Aliyah home, Marion also began her secular education in Dutch at a nearby Montessori school. The teaching was patient and caring. Dutch was a new language for 11-year-old Marion, as well as Hebrew. Before that, she had known only German. Albert, too, was now learning Dutch. He and Ziv Birnbaum, along with other teenagers from the home, commuted daily by train to a secondary school in Amsterdam. Ruth, meantime, remained in Amsterdam. She had moved in with Walter's sister, Rosie, who had lived in hiding in Holland during the war, and she was studying to become a beautician and manicurist. It was during this time that Uncle Ernst offered to have Marion's eye condition corrected. "I'm so ashamed now," Marion said, "when I think of how I behaved." Uncle Ernst arranged for me to come to Amsterdam by train. As this was to be a surprise for my mother, he met me at the station and took me to the hospital where the operation was to be performed. I was, of course, quite nervous, but I was also happy at the thought of having my eyes straightened and perhaps not having to wear glasses anymore. At the hospital, Uncle Ernst put me in the hands of the nurses who were to prepare me for the operation. Somehow, as I was left lying on the stretcher in a room all by myself for what seemed like a very long time, no one came to my side. No one was there to reassure me. Suddenly, I was seized with panic. Maybe it was my years in the camp that told me I must escape and save myself. In any case, I jumped up from the stretcher, found my belongings, ran all the way to the railroad station, and returned to Busum. What a terrible thing to do! But patient and kind as always, Uncle Ernst understood the reason for my flight. The surgery was rescheduled, and this time he insisted on being allowed to remain at my side until I was wheeled into the operating room. Mama, too, was there, and the operation was a success. I recovered quickly, and my eyes were soon able to function normally. Ruth finally completed her beautician's training and received her certification, qualifying her to give facials, manicures, and pedicures. Learning the terminology for the muscles and tissues in Dutch had been difficult for her, but she was determined to succeed. Once she was certified, she bought a bicycle to travel to the homes of her clients. Her visits with Marion and Albert, however, were limited to once a week at most. Either she came to Busum by train or the children traveled to Amsterdam. Even though the Birnbaums were like second parents to us and Susie became my dear friend, which she has remained to this day, Marion said, I was terribly lonely for my mother. I had learned in Bergen-Belsen to suppress my feelings and not to cry out even in physical pain. So I kept these deep anxieties to myself in order not to worry my mother. But often I was close to hysteria, and I could hear my heart pounding in my chest as if it were about to burst. As the time grew closer for the planned voyage from Holland to Palestine, the Blumenthals learned that the immigration was to be a children's transport only, and that the group would have to travel illegally by way of the island of Cyprus in the Eastern Mediterranean. Ruth would not be allowed to accompany Marion and Albert. She would have to make her own arrangements and hope to arrive at a later date. After all we had been through, Mama said, I could not possibly risk such a separation. Often the illegal ships were old and leaky, and if the British came upon such a ship, they would force it to return to Europe. How could I put my children's lives in danger again? So at once I went about seeing what we could do to emigrate as a family to the United States, as Walter and I had originally intended. Again, it was necessary to obtain an affidavit from a family member or other sponsor in America, as well as a visa and other papers. This time, the affidavit was generously offered by a brother of Tante Rosie's husband, a warm and caring man whom the Blumenthals had never met. His name was Arnold Wolfe. The remaining arrangements took time, but there was one piece of very good news. The Holland America line still had on it record that the Blumenthals had paid their passage for four in 1938 when they first planned to sail from Rotterdam to New York on the Nieuwe Amsterdam. Now, nearly 10 years later, the passage money was still on deposit and could be applied to a sailing on the SS Vendeme. The cost of the sailing had gone up, but Papa's share would be passed on to the others, and only a small sum needed to be added. What an exciting time, Marion said, when we finally had everything in readiness and our passage date approached. It was April 1948. I was nearly 13 and a half, had filled out and grown taller. Also, I had very definite ideas about what kind of wardrobe I wanted for the sailing and for my arrival in New York. Clothing and shoes were still rationed in Holland, so Mama and I had constant arguments about what items the valuable coupons should be used for. One thing I badly needed was a pair of new shoes. Mama had to give up her shoe coupon so that I could have them, and of course, she felt I should choose a pair of sensible black or brown leather Oxfords. By this time, we were buying my shoes one size too big because I was growing so rapidly. When I looked at those terrible candle boats Mama wanted me to get, I was practically in tears. As usual, we argued back and forth, but my will had become stronger than ever, and finally I won. When I boarded the Van Damme a week or so later, I was wearing a pair of fashionable navy blue slip-on pumps. I felt completely ready for New York and my new life in America. For Marion and Albert, the 10-day voyage was luxurious beyond anything they had ever known. The shipboard food was abundant, varied, delicious, and beautifully served. Marion could not get over the many flavors and colors of ice cream, a dessert that was available at almost any time of day. If this was a foretaste of life in America, she was sure that it was going to suit her perfectly. On the evening before the Van Damme was to land, the passengers were told to be on deck early next morning if they wished to see the approach into New York Harbor. Mama, Albert, and I, Marion said, were part of the huge crowd that started to gather as early as 5 a.m., all of us craning our necks for a first view of the Statue of Liberty. When the tall figure of that longed-for symbol of freedom appeared, I became too choked to speak. So many emotions seized me at once: joy and gratitude, bitterness for the cruelties we and so many others had suffered, and deep sadness that Papa could not share this moment with us. He would never know that we had reached America at last. The date of our landing was April 23, 1948. By coincidence, it was exactly 3 years to the day since we had been liberated from the death camp by the Russians. Chapter 9, America at Last. The Van Damme docked at Hoboken, New Jersey. There, Mama, Marion, and Albert were met by the family of Papa's sister Clara, who, with her husband and daughter, had emigrated to the United States in 1938. The Blumenthals were taken directly to Tante Clara's small, immaculate apartment on West 161st Street in the Washington Heights section of Manhattan. "From the moment we left the ship," Marion recalled, "I was in a state of bewilderment and awe. No city in Germany or Holland had ever had so many tall buildings as New York. So much motor traffic, so many people, such noisy, bustling streets. And I had yet to ride in the fast-moving elevator of a skyscraper or to descend into the rattling and screeching subways." Immediately, I found a friend in my cousin Helga, who was a few years younger than I. She shared her pastimes and her companions with me. Tante Clara, meanwhile, tried to make us as comfortable as possible. She cooked us delicious meals. I had only one fault to find. We had arrived in America just as the Passover holiday, with its many food restrictions, was about to begin. I could make do with eating matzah, our unleavened bread, instead of raised bread, but many sweets that I had been looking forward to were not kosher for Passover. Above all, here in the land of chewing gum, slim sugary sticks in many flavors and chiclets galore, I had to wait 8 whole days for the holiday to be over before I could indulge my craving. Bubblegum was a new variation that fascinated me. A few weeks later, when I learned to use the subways, I sat gazing in wonder at the huge bubbles that some of my fellow passengers were able to blow. Almost as dramatic were the sharp cracking sounds they made as their jaws clamped down on the gum. I soon learned that to chew gum, especially in public, is not a very mannerly thing to do. I suppose it was the abundance of it in the United States, as compared to its scarcity in post-war Holland, that impressed me so. Like the Blumenthals' brief stay with the DeLevy family in Amsterdam, their time at Tante Clara's in New York soon came to an end. As kind as their relatives had been in both instances, Ruth knew that she and her children must somehow make their own way. On arriving in the United States, the Blumenthals had registered with HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. While HIAS tried to find a Jewish community that could offer the newcomers a place to live and a temporary means of support, the organization moved them into a residence hotel on Manhattan's 116th Street. "The three of us lived in one room," Marion said, "with a bathroom in the corridor that we shared with other families. As there were no proper cooking facilities, our meals became very peculiar. Albert had developed a terrific appetite for canned fruit cocktail. It was nothing for him to banish a 16-ounce can at one sitting and go right on to open another. I, on the other hand, had a passion for fatty foods. My favorite was a big jar of mayonnaise into which I dipped one potato chip after another, out of the biggest bag I could find. It was no wonder I was putting on weight. At the age of 10 and a half, just after our liberation, I weighed 35 pounds. Now, in the spring of 1948, at age 13 and a half, I weighed 135. In 3 years, I had gained 100 pounds. Ruth was quietly indulgent of the eating habits of her two teenagers. She did not take as much pleasure as they did, however, in the American snack foods or in other aspects of American culture. She was far too taken up with worry about the problem of starting over. She had no money and no job skills that she could apply without a knowledge of English. She felt completely lost in her new surroundings. To me, Ruth confessed, the future looked bleak. The Blumenthals had been rooming in the Manhattan Residence Hotel only a few weeks when they were notified that HIAS had found them a more permanent place to live. It was being offered by the Jewish Community Council in Peoria, Illinois. "Peoria," Marion said. "We had never heard of Peoria. I'm not even sure we knew enough American geography at this time to have heard of Illinois. New York itself was strange and new to us, but at least we had relatives there. In Peoria, we wouldn't know anybody. However, we had no choice. If we did not accept the free housing and the chance for work and schooling in Peoria, we would lose our HIAS sponsorship and would be entirely on our own. Without a proper wage earner in the family, there was no way for us to survive financially. So we packed our few belongings and set off by train for the American Midwest." On arriving in Peoria in June 1948, Ruth, Marion, and Albert discovered that their new apartment in a rundown part of town was to be shared with two other families. Everyone would have to take turns using the single bathroom and preparing meals in the kitchen, which was equipped with an old-fashioned wooden icebox. But at least here was an opportunity for newcomers to establish themselves in an American community. "That very summer," Marion said, "each of us got a job. Mama, finding nothing else open to her, started working as a housekeeper for a prosperous family in town, the Holkins. Albert was hired by a local jewelry store. He scrubbed the floors and cleaned and polished the showcases and counters. And I went to work in a laundry, sorting and folding clothes for 20 cents an hour. I also began to take lessons in English. In September, I entered public school in Peoria. I was still so far behind in English, however, that I was placed in fourth grade. There I was, a 13-year-old among 9-year-olds. Not only was I 4 years older than my classmates, but I had also grown plump and was beginning to mature. My teacher tried to be helpful, but she was a rather nervous person, as I recall, and she spoke very rapidly. I could not help feeling out of place and uncomfortable. Although I excelled in mathematics and in European geography, English was my big stumbling block. Along with Dutch and Hebrew, it was my third new language in 3 years. Albert was also wrestling with English at school. Yet both young people continued at their jobs, putting in as many after-school hours as they could, for every penny counted. Ruth's work at the Hokins brought in some extras, too, for her employer was generous with take-home food and with hand-me-down clothing for Marion that was still in fine condition. In December 1948, Marion recalled, we celebrated our first Hanukkah in Peoria. This 8-day festival of lights fell close to my 14th birthday, so Albert bought me a special gift, one that was typical of the new luxuries that were available to us in America. When I opened the box, however, I was so disappointed that I actually started to cry. I suppose I had expected a box of elegant chocolates or some other confectionery treat. Instead, he had bought me a pair of sheer, flesh-colored nylon stockings. Nylon had first made their appearance in America shortly before the war. Then, as the miracle fiber was needed for parachutes and other war materials, it had become unavailable. Now, in 1948, everybody was clamoring for nylon hosiery. But to me, getting my first pair of nylons was a sign of having to grow up, of becoming a young woman. This I was not ready to do. I was not ready to say farewell to the childhood I had never had. I wanted sweets and games. I wanted to be as carefree as my 9-year-old classmates, who knew nothing of the deadly concentration camp in which I had spent the 9th and 10th years of my childhood. The following year saw an all-around improvement in the lives of the Blumenthals. Ruth learned that her longtime skills as a seamstress had good earning power, and she went to work for a local tailor. Later, she advanced to an even better job doing alterations and custom tailoring for a downtown Peoria department store. Albert, who was enrolled in Peoria Central High School, had kept his job in the jewelry store and even gotten a raise. He worked his way up to an assistant clerkship, increasing his earnings from 35 to 55 cents an hour. Marion not only held on to her job in the laundry, but began to earn additional money as a babysitter. By pooling their earnings and living very frugally, the Blumenthals were now able to move from the community-sponsored quarters in Peoria to a modest apartment of their own. But best of all for Marion was her progress at school. By getting extra help with English after school and by attending summer school, I had skipped that fall to junior high. For the first time, I had that wonderful feeling of belonging. Happily, I had gotten some good advice from one of the mothers for whom I babysat. She noticed my tendency to eat too rich foods as a way of compensating for my years of hunger, and she gently advised me about the importance of maintaining a good appearance. I listened to her, as I might not have to my own mother, and I soon began to slim down. Being accepted by the boys and girls in my class was enough compensation for me. The Blumenthals found that Peoria was turning out to be a comfortable and secure place to live after all. There were varied opportunities for employment, there was a good public school system, and there was a Jewish religious community. By the time Marion was in high school, she was working part-time in one of the city's department stores. "I sold house dresses at Zolt's department store," she recalled. "One for $1.59, two for $3. The store was owned by Henrietta Zolt's nephews. Henrietta Zolt's, who had died in 1945 at the age of 85, was one of the founders of Hadassah, which was organized in 1912 to promote a Jewish homeland in Palestine. She was the first president of Hadassah and also the director of a youth Aliyah program, similar to the one we'd taken part in Holland. Albert and I had also started to teach Sunday school classes, which brought in a few extra dollars. Somehow, we seemed to find time for work, school, and a bit of social life. I also became more active in the Peoria religious community and began to attend synagogue services. The High Holy Days of 1951 found Marion seated in the women's balcony of Peoria's Orthodox Synagogue. In this branch of the Jewish faith, it was traditional for men and women to be separated at services, but a small section at the rear of the balcony had been reserved for students attending Peoria's Bradley University. I will always remember what I was wearing on that first day of Yom Kippur that autumn. It was a knitted navy blue wool jersey dress with an embroidered motif in red near the right shoulder. The dress was a hand-me-down that I had been lucky to receive, for I could never have afforded something as lovely as that new. A number of Bradley students, mostly young men, were gathered behind us. When I glanced around, I noticed one who was staring at me intently. I tried to put my mind on the services, but it was hard not to take just one more look. When I did, his eyes were still on me. I was 16 at the time and a sophomore in high school. I had only recently started dating and was enjoying going out with a variety of boys. I never dreamed of getting serious with any one person. I was certain that that would not happen for years to come. When the service ended, the young man approached Marion and asked her very politely if he could walk her home from the synagogue. As they strolled along on that Yom Kippur afternoon, Marion learned that the young man's home was in the Long Island, New York community of Woodmere, a place she had never heard of. He had fine manners and spoke lovingly of his family back home, consisting of his parents and his sister Naomi. He himself was 19 and had 3 more years of college. Somehow, Marion said, I knew even then that this person was someone special. Already, my new admirer seemed to have made up his mind that we were meant for each other. And as our courtship continued, lengthening into a period of almost 2 years, I began to realize that he was the man with whom I would spend the rest of my life. His name was Nathaniel Lazon. Epilogue. In June 1953, Marian Blumenthal graduated from Peoria Central High School. She was 18 and a half and was rated 8th in scholarly achievement in a graduating class of 265 students. Nathaniel's parents visited from New York and joined Mama and Albert in attending the graduation. Nathaniel had just finished his junior year at Bradley and had to complete one more year of college for his degree. Yet he had convinced both his parents and Marian's family that the young couple should marry that summer. On August 2, 1953, Marian Blumenthal and Nathaniel Lazon were married in New York. Their first child, David Walter, born in 1955, their daughter, Susan, in 1957, and their third child, Michael, in 1960. Today, Marian and her husband have 5 grandchildren. They have made their home for many years in Hewlett, New York. For the past 15 years, Marian has been given talks and interviews about her Holocaust experience to both children and adults in schools and other settings, and has at last been able to put her story into book form. On completion of this undertaking, one more challenge awaited her, that of revisiting the sights and scenes of her childhood. In April 1995, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of her family's liberation from the Nazis, Marian Blumenthal Lazon, accompanied by her husband, her daughter Susan, and her son Michael, reunited with other Westerbork and Bergen-Belsen survivors in Holland and Germany. In addition to the former concentration camps, the Lazons visited the graves of Marian's father in Trobitz and Marian's hometown of Hoya. Although she approached her journey with deep anxiety, Marian soon found herself responding positively to her German hosts. Especially moving was the reception tended to the Lazons in Hoya by the Huth family, Heike and Hans and their teenage daughter and son, Sarah and Henning. As conscientious German residents, the Huths had taken on a post-war research project to reconstruct the history of the town's Jewish community. In 1992, the fruits of their study, tracing Jewish life in Hoya from 1754 to the Holocaust and its aftermath, were published in a volume titled Wann wird Mensch Vertex? When Will People Ever Understand? Similarly, in Trobitz, a local historian, Erica Alt, had made it her mission to research and compile a history of the death train. Also, the graves of those Jews who were laid to rest in Trobitz had been looked after since the late 1940s by the cemetery's German caretaker, Heinz Farber. Today, this German village has the rare distinction of having an honorary Jewish cemetery in which there are 79 individually marked burial sites. Here, unlike the mass burial sites of almost all Holocaust victims, the names of the dead are recorded for posterity. Albert Blumenthal and his wife Diane reside in Atherton, California, where he is a financial consultant. His advanced degrees include an MBA in finance and marketing from Northwestern University. In 1958, while on army duty in Europe, he made his first trip to Hoya, the town in Germany where he had been born. The fate of its Jewish community was then unknown, and its Jewish cemetery was in ruins. Subsequent visits took places in 1983 and again in 1993, at which time he also visited the sites of Westerbork and Bergen-Belsen and his father's grave at Trobitz. Ruth Blumenthal Mayberg remained in Peoria until 1956 and subsequently lived in California and in New York, where she still resides. In her 87th year, she is a spirited, energetic woman, a survivor in the truest sense. She continues to be a vital presence in the lives of those she sustained through the Holocaust and its aftermath.